Goeiemôre.
Dankie.
Dis die laaste Afrikaans wat jy van my gaan hoor. I do apologize. Rob Rose is fluent in Afrikaans. But please, I think I would prefer it if people want to speak Afrikaans during this conversation, and it's a conversation between myself and the authors, and but with yourselves as well. And this is not necessarily confined to English. I just want to introduce two people who have produced books on the Steinhoff saga in the last year, right? You both published last year.
Yes.
James Brent Stein, whose book appears in English and Afrikaans, was out of the blocks first. And I'm not a critic, okay? So I'm not telling you which book is better here, because he beat Rob Rose to the shelves. Rob Rose followed up with.
I had more pictures, Peter.
It's true. So James is Steinhoff, Inside SA's Biggest Corporate Crash. Rob Rose came with Stein Heist, Marcus Yusser, Steinhoff, and SA's Biggest Corporate Fraud. There's a bit of marketing from me on the back of this book, which I won't read out to you. But just to say that, and I want to ask a question of you before we start interviewing, but these books are both really worth the read, and it is a very dense and difficult and complex story, as you all know. Quite how this man stole money and ended up losing and ended up impoverishing large numbers of people is remarkable, and it's not even begun to be told fully yet. These books are simply a start. They are the work of hardworking journalists who found out what they could. There's been no access to official reports, the police, or whatever it might be. This is their work, and we owe them a lot for this, because it enables us to at least begin to understand quite what Marcus Yusser did. And before I begin to interview them, I just want to ask if there's anybody in the room today who was invested in Steinhoff and who's lost money because of it. No, it's not funny. I mean, it's you have all of our sympathy, I'm sure. Peter DeToy at the end is a senior editor at Rob. Sorry, James. James is you're an analyst, right? I mean,
no, in my day job.
Yeah.
No, I work for the Western Cape government.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, there you go.
Yes.
Rob Rose is the editor of the Financial Mail. And Peter DeToy is a senior editor at News 24. He's the author of a book, a co-author of a book called Enemy of the People, about one Jacob Zuma, and soon to be the author on his own of a book about the Stellenbosch Mafia, which we will talk about during the course of the next hour. First, I just want to ask you, James, and Rob, because you've written these books, why is Marcus Yusser not in jail? You can answer it in your... there's no point going through all of this.
It's very simple, Peter. It's a simple answer. The state doesn't have the capacity to investigate and prosecute these kind of cases. The Hawks, the police's priority crimes unit, the Hawks, they are the best of the best. They have a extra special unit, even better than Benny Griesel. That special unit is called the Commercial Crimes Unit. They are the experts, the best of the best. They do not have a single CA or auditor in their service. I mean, it's astounding. So what they do is, when there's a big event, they go out on a tender and they will get people in. That's what they say in any event. But that's simply the fact of the matter. There's no people. I'm sure Rob can expand a bit more. The same with the NPA. I mean, do we have the prosecutorial skills to understand this? But that's another debate. But simply, when it comes to the investigation, the plain old beat cop sitting in the police station, he says, we refer this to the Hawks, and the Hawks, you know, they just don't do anything.
Would you have the same answer, Rob? Because you mention a moment in your book at the beginning where Steinhoff buys the knives in the forest, basically, or a large chunk of it, and he does what he does for the rest of his life. He does a deal with a related party, and he's found guilty in the High Court, and he gets off in the Court of Appeal.
Well, I mean, I suppose that's. I mean, firstly, that was a SARS matter. This thing they warned me would be terrible, but I think it was a SARS matter, and it was a civil matter rather than any criminal thing. I mean, I think in this case, Peter, what I think is that, I mean, I agree with James that the state is denuded when it comes to these complex cases, which is why nobody goes to prison. But I also think that the Hawks, you know, the person in charge of this particular case, the Steinhoff case, is the guy who was leading the Prasa prosecution. And Popo Malefe, the chairman of Prasa, had to go to court to force them to do their job, to get an interdict forcing them to just do their job. So the guy is hopelessly incompetent, for one. Secondly, they are waiting for the results of the PwC forensic report to come out. But I think the best chance of anyone going to jail in this is if the other implicated parties who helped Marcus Huster do what he did get Section 204 and essentially turn the state's witness against Marcus. And I think that that's a process that is on the way, and I think that that will be the best chance they've got, because if they were to leave it to their own investigative prowess, you know, we'll be at WordFest in 2029.
You both make the point in your book that he is down but not out. I mean, he's still powerful, still influential, in your case, in horse racing. I mean, does he have the power to persuade people not to turn state witness? Can he interfere?
I don't think he can interfere at the moment. He seems too insular. I think he's looking after his own back. I don't think that he would. The kind of people, specifically the four people at the very close circle of Marcus, against whom charges have already been laid, I think they would, at least one or two of them, would happily testify against Marcus. So I do think that that's the only way that they can secure a proper conviction against him. Do you agree? Or?
Yeah, I guess. But I don't think we must forget something, and I'm sure Peter can jump in here as well. The brotherhood... that's very tight. That's come over decades. I mean, we're sitting next to Volkanov right here, where these guys met one another, and I'll go out that exit when I leave. But Volkanov, of course, says he's right here. This is where these guys met up. This is where he meets Rian du Plessis, his best friend, basically, who goes and becomes the CEO of Pumalela Racing for years, where they run a nice little side operation, where a number of the senior management that Steinhoff originated from. And that's a long, long... And it goes beyond being friends. It goes to being Afrikaners, loving rugby and Brannewein and Braaivleis. It's a bond that goes beyond... So it's very difficult to break that up, I think. And so there's got to be real pressure put on these guys, the other two that you're talking about, for them to really understand they are really going to go to jail before I think they're really going to crack open like a walnut. So it's going to be interesting.
But Peter, wouldn't you agree?
Sorry?
Wouldn't you agree that in this case, I mean, I think a lot of the anger you've felt when you spoke to people who were deceived by Marcus is very tangible, partly because it was people in the inner circle who were deceived. So I think that anger is even more acute, which will lead people to testify against him. People I know who have given evidence already to the police and the authorities are some of Marcus's closest friends, and they feel particularly betrayed by him. So I think that perhaps the sense of betrayal is far more acute.
I suppose there's two processes here. There's the legal process, the criminal justice process, and that's what we spoke about now. We know the Hawks have been decimated. We know what happened to the National Prosecuting Authority. You know, just last week it came out that Robert McBride wrote a number of letters to the former national director imploring him to prosecute a number of criminals in the police, and nothing happened. So, and Rob and James are very involved in the legal process, and that's there's no end to it soon. We can't see progress at the moment. But as far as Stellenbosch goes, and as far as people turning against Marcus goes, I would agree with Rob that there was enormous anger in Stellenbosch after that happened, and there were a number of anecdotal pieces of evidence of friends of Marcus who drove to his house in Hermanus the day after or the weekend after, knocking on his door demanding to find out what happened, and Marcus just refused to open the door. So friends that he enticed to invest in his business, and the betrayal was quite big. Now, Steinhoff, when it came to Stellenbosch a decade or so ago, you know, it was the new money. It was flash. They built that flash headquarters down in Stellenbosch Street across the Rupert Art Museum, incidentally, next to Remgro's headquarters. And, you know, the contrast between Remgro, which is an old Stellenbosch institution and the new money from Steinhoff was quite big. So I would agree with Rob that there is a sense of betrayal amongst many in Stellenbosch that they feel towards
you. And is there a mafia here? I mean, if you speak to, if you ask Johan, which I'm sure you've done, Johan Rupert, he will deny it. Well, certainly he'll deny being part of it. I've left Stellenbosch, he says, and I'm in Somerset West, basically. And no, it's true. I mean, it's, you know, that's the answer. That's a stock answer.
Well, if you cast your mind back when the Steinhoff crash happened, the first thing the cut maker tweeted, you know, Jan Rupert's Twitter handle was, what irritates him is the impact that this is going to have on Stellenbosch, because he detests the incomers, the people that are coming from the outside.
Yeah.
Even though he doesn't live here, he holds a very strong affinity to the town. So if you ask the question, is there a mafia? No, not officially, but there are very strong networks and bonds. Yeah, and James spoke about Vilgenhof residence just next door. So there is a strong network. There's strong bonds between people, and you know, they certainly use it.
Yeah. I just want to come in and say one thing, Peter, because I mean, of course, there's a lot of betrayal and angry people. But what I'm just cautious and wary about is how many of those very angry people they've lost money, which is why they sold the Murin. Okay, so do they really have the dirt? So they can go and testify all they want and say, look, this guy, I lost 20 million or whatever, but do they have the evidence to put to actually charge this guy and put him away? That's the question.
My
hypothesis would be, this guy is not a fool. This is how he got away with this stuff for 20, 25 years. And the real people with the real evidence, with the real ability to really build up a case against him, they're the ones that must go and testify. And I'm sure one or two of these...
Who would those be, like, for instance? Well, would they be the related parties?
Yes, completely. I mean, the guys in Europe, for example.
Yes.
The head of the guys in Germany who were putting together these deals.
Yeah.
But you know, on that point, there is somebody. I think the best and most the simplest case against Marcus is the SMS that he sent to a friend of his a couple of weeks before Steinhoff crashed, saying along the lines of, "You always ask about how the business is going, and some things might happen, and I think now might be a good time to sell your shares." Now that is a classic. Mm. Open and shut case of insider trading, and the financial services conduct.
He was giving that advice to friends.
He sent that via an SMS, and the FSCA, the regulator, has that SMS. Now that's a clear sign. You know things are going to come out.
Yeah.
You're telling people now might be a good time to sell your shares. No. Never mind the other stuff. Never mind the fraud. That's a very blunt and seemingly obvious.
Can I just make the point though that if Marcus Yuster was a black guy, and he was somehow connected to the ANC, and and he had done this, there'd be a completely different kind of outcry, wouldn't there? I mean, it would be obviously investors who'd lost their money, but it would have been a case of, oh, it's just typical, isn't it? You know, the new elite, et cetera, et cetera. They see Steve corrupt as hell, et cetera, et cetera. How much damage has South African business, established business, done to itself in the past 5 or 10 years?
Well,
with the Guptas and now with... I mean, for Deloitte to give this guy clean audits for however long they were his auditor, and only come up at the end with you know, concerns after they'd been pointed out for years, is also crazy. The accounting profession in this country has really got a credibility problem. And I always remember my dad telling me, become a chartered accountant, son, you know, you'll be rich. Well, I let him down, unfortunately, but...
Maybe there's a difference, Peter, between, in a sense, because I think there's an element of truth to that, but I would argue in a sense that private sector, it's like, well, it's rich people's money anyway, so who cares? Whereas the Guptas and state capture was very real, hospitals, prisons, issues that affect the poorest of everybody and affects everybody. So in a sense, I think that might be a way why we don't see this kind of groundswell of anger and outrage that you might have picked up with the Guptas, I would imagine.
Well, I think the outrage was certainly there. If you think back to when it happened in December 2017, it was just after the Bell Pottinger project. It was just after the whole debate and the phrase white monopoly capital became in vogue. So it was almost a godsend for the defenders of the Guptas, the defenders of the state capture project to show, look at the private sector. The private sector are just as bad. And it was almost a counterweight to what happened with the Guptas. I agree with James, and certainly, I mean, I think we all agree that there's a difference, you know, with the state capture project that specifically targeted the state's procurement processes, you know, the state's spend on goods and services every year. But it did highlight the fact that corruption in the private sector is as rife as in the public sector.
But I also think that we do feel a bit removed from a private sector case like this. You know, it's easy to see your tax money disappearing and say, that's my tax money disappearing into this. In this case, it's almost a one remove. People have to realize that 70% of our pension money, or the pensions in this country, were invested in Steinhoff. So there is an exposure, but it's slightly more removed. You don't sense the immediate impact of that. And also, we're quite a political society. We think in terms of political news a lot. To understand something like Steinhoff, it's far more complicated.
We're too conservative. But, I mean, Steinhoff did make people in this room poorer. And maybe people in this room lost their savings. You know, and it worries me that while it's been a well-covered story, that we haven't seen, we don't see enough of what the Americans would do and go and find people who'd lost money and ask them how it affected their lives, you know, because they were planning maybe to send a kid to you know, a good university overseas, and now they can't, or they were going to have an operation and now they can't.
I suppose we can't talk in circles all the time, but it does come back to the failure of the criminal justice system to put people into jail. Now, as we sit here, the State Capture Commission is listening to evidence around the collapse of Eskom, because that's where we are now. We haven't seen people in orange jumpsuits go to jail.
Well, presumably before the election, if you were Cyril Ramaphosa, you would encourage indirectly your new head of the NPA to arrest somebody.
It's got to be someone big and someone who wears...
So the latest rumor is that Brian Molefe is in trouble. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But I can't imagine him, you know, just sticking with one sort of black... one big head that would roll. You know, if he were able to get Marcus Yuster into a pair of handcuffs at the same time as getting somebody from Eskom or somebody from the state capture side, he'd do himself a lot of good politically. I mean, and he's a very calculating guy. Everything he does is about the election.
I'm going to disagree slightly again, Peter.
It's okay.
And the reason is the people that needs to be nailed first is the people sitting next to him in Parliament. It's next to him and behind him. I mean, we've got several senior cabinet ministers who've been implicated as severely, if not worse, than Brian Molefe. So it would be disingenuous at best if he goes after the smaller fish with respect, like Brian Molefe, and he doesn't target the people in his own party.
But the way it works, and the way it works in the ANC anyway, in this government, is that the officials take the blame, not the politicians. And that's what will happen. That's what will happen here.
But it's a complicated saga. I mean, you know, and we spoke about the failure or the lack of expertise and skills. If you talk to the ex-SARS guys, the rogue unit guys, the people that targeted the illicit tobacco trade, you know, they would tell you that even just based on evidence in the public domain, there's enough evidence to go to a judge in the High Court and ask for a preservation order to freeze all his assets, freeze all his bank accounts, and then at least start the investigation.
Yeah.
But those skills are gone. SARS doesn't have those skills anymore. You know, they're trying to build up a new investigations unit, but, you know, the skills that have been built up since Pravin's era in 97, since then, that's gone.
But you've also seen Estina. I mean, they did go and arrest...
Estina.
They did go and arrest people after... you know, the day after their ANC elective conference. Mm. And because they botched up that investigation, they had to cancel that arrest warrant, essentially the seizure.
Yeah.
So if you rush to arrest somebody and you botch it up because your investigative skills are nowhere, it's even more embarrassing when you have to withdraw the charges.
And that wasn't too difficult, was it?
Yeah, right? I mean, it's
well,
so blatant.
I mean, clearly it was. But, I mean, surely, do you have any faith in the appointment of the new head of the NPA, Shamila Batohi? She's going to be given an investigating directorate, which will be, in other words, something that's completely free of influence from the deputy directors who've always been Zuma people. Does that directorate, once it's decreed, have an opportunity to break some eggs?
Well, you know, it was announced in the beginning of February. It's almost a month. We don't know. It hasn't been proclamated or proclaimed in the government gazette yet. So we don't know. What we do know is that it won't be the Scorpions 2.0, which is what we hoped for. It will have more independence than it previously had. And it will pull in expertise from the police, which means that they will work under a prosecutor.
So they can go out, they can go to accounting firms and get from PwC.
Exactly. So the investigative officer will be able to seize evidence and give it to a prosecutor, and the prosecutor will say, I need A, B, and C, whereas in the past, you know, it was just sent off into the ether and you just hoped that someone at Victoria Mkenge building in Silverton would decide, let's prosecute them.
The added challenge, I think, and you see it at the Hawks as well, where you've got a new boss who's coming who's a better guy than the previous guy. Yeah. But the levels, you've got 9 provincial heads, you've got several deputies below them, and Shamila is going to sit with the same problem. So it doesn't matter if you are, how do I put it nicely, if you are the Lord himself and you're in charge of the MPA and everyone below you is a Judas. It's going to be very, very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. I just want to, if I can, jump back on the auditing point you made, because that's another important point. Deloitte audited this company for more than 25 years, from the very, very, very beginning. We are all entrusting our money, buying shares, stocks into companies like Steinhoff, and we're doing it based, amongst others, on the word of companies like Deloitte, KPMG, PwC.
Yeah.
What recourse is there for that, Rob? And, I mean, there are obvious things in the Steinhoff accounts when you look back in hindsight. It's obviously, hindsight's perfect. But if you just look at the tax rate Steinhoff was paying, between 8 and 16% per year for 16 years odd, while they are making record profits. And the auditors didn't highlight it once. I think that deserves a lot of attention
that
as
is,
well.
It is amazing. And there was the firm, the mattress company, right?
Mm. Mattress firm, yeah.
The mattress firm. Which he paid
double
what the share price was. Mm. And nobody, help me understand this. You're on the board of Steinhoff, right? And you previously run Absa Bank. and you're on the audit committee.
Or let's say Sanlam.
Hey?
Or let's say Sanlam.
Yes.
Or let's say Sanlam. And you've run Sanlam and you've run Absa. No matter how thick the board pack is and how boring it might be to have to go through, why don't you spot that, and why don't you ask a question?
See, I spoke to a lot of the directors, and I think they did ask questions. They just didn't ask enough questions, and they weren't skeptical enough. Johan van Zyl, for example, is quite forthright about that, about how much longer they should have spent scrutinizing that. But essentially, I had a sense from the board that they were far more credulous. They were not skeptical enough. They believed what management said.
But is that because this is the problem? When I come back to maybe to a description of, I don't know whether it's Afrikaner capitalism or South African capitalism or, you know, white capitalism or traditional established business or just capitalism. Why is it that these boards are so, everybody looks alike, you know, everybody makes the same assumptions, everybody trusts each other. What about a board where nobody trusts each other? Wouldn't that be interesting? I mean, I don't know whether the company would go anywhere, but we seem to be, as South Africans, trapped in this thing where everybody knows everybody. Len Kona, who was on the board of Steinhoff, was on at least 10 other boards. How can you possibly keep up?
It's not only South Africa, though, Peter. I mean, you think of the Times Corp, for example, in the States. Rupert Murdoch loaded that board with all of his friends and family. So it's not only here. It's a global phenomenon. And it, in my view, it's got something to do with these corporates that are all powerful, that in a sense, and the other side, the states and the regulators that are out of balance, that aren't able to keep up in regulating and saying, you can't be on 10 boards. You can only be a non-executive director if you're there for 3 years, for example. There's got to be an element of diversity.
And your incentive is you want yes men on the board because they'll help you get things done easier. Heather Son, who's now the chairman, told me that when she arrived, every single person at Steinhoff was a CA. She said even the media relations person, who generally is a kind of a bad BA dropout and would generally become a journalist like us, was a CA, which is staggering.
It's interesting when you talk about boards. You know, the people that I spoke to in Stellenbosch who knew Marcus pretty well when he served on a number of boards here too, so that he was beyond doubt one of the best members of boards that they've ever had. He was the only guy often that read his press or his board packs from cover to cover. He knew exactly what was going on in all these businesses, on the boards that he sat on, and he knew which questions to ask, which made it all the more surprising for these people and members of the so-called mafia when the bomb burst, that he was able to hoodwink his colleagues and his partners to such a degree that Steinhoff crashed. But he was an incredibly, or he still is, I suppose, a forceful character that was able to manipulate his board, but also when he served on other boards, to also play a very strong role on those boards. So it's quite an anomaly that someone like this is well respected as a non-exec.
Presumably, because one of the reasons he would be respected and would know what was going on is because the board packs that he would have got would have been telling him more or less the truth about Company X, whereas his board packs did just the opposite. Did he Rob Rose, was he, I'm just trying to think why somebody turns bad, you know, is it you make one mistake and then you try and cover it up and you end up getting into more and more trouble? Or did, you know, was he dropped on his head when he was a kid and nobody picked him up? Or is there some psychological explanation? Does something happen to him to make him bad?
How can anybody...
The story that most affected me out of the whole Steinhoff saga was G.T. Ferreira's pension fund for his workers. I don't know if G.T. is in the audience or not, but... But he had built up this fantastic thing, and Steinhoff used to persuade him to put the fund all into Steinhoff, and so it's now worth nothing, right? Who does that to people that... Who does that to complete strangers? I mean, he knew GT, but he didn't know the people who he was trying to help, the workers and the farm.
So I think that question is the most fascinating. Why does somebody do this, and how does it lead to this? And that's such a difficult question. But I do think on that last point of GT, people who end up in these positions don't think that it's going to collapse like this. They think they make one error, they'll cover it up, they'll cover up the next one, and ultimately I think they foresee a situation where things improve and they're able to plug a hole and come out right. I don't think Marcus envisaged this scenario of everything collapsing. And the psychology of white-collar criminals... I spoke to a Harvard professor who was really fascinating about this. He wrote a book on it called Why They Do It. Is that they're actually helping people by covering up the hole. I'm helping my investors. I'm helping people not deal with the stress I have to deal with. And it gets to that position. But psychologically, that inflection point where you could reveal to investors that things are turning bad and you choose not to do it because of various reasons. In Marcus's case, when the JD Group purchase was happening, he wanted to dress up Steinhoff's accounts, make them look fantastic for the listing in Germany the next year. So he had an incentive to make things look great. But that inflection point where you make the wrong decision, I think, is what separates people who end up bad and people who end up good.
Peter, if I may, I think don't discount the psychopathic tendencies where you don't give a hoot. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's had a girlfriend for how many years? Who many knows how many other girlfriends he's had? That's a deep sense of betrayal. For one thing, he just didn't care, and he was at a stage. I don't think he cared about the money anymore. He's a billionaire many times over. It became about the game. It became about having Johan van Zyl and Steve Boysen on the board and knowing something they don't know and making these deals, even though it's the stupidest bloody thing to go and buy Mattress Firm. And yes, all these guys just say, just go along for the ride. It's all about a power game. It's about getting GT's money in there and you knowing everything everybody else doesn't know. And I think those, not that I'm a psycho expert, but those are tendencies that one could say, look, there's some serious psychological problems there.
What happened to the people who, for years before Steinhoff became a kind of a household name, were warning that that there was something dodgy? You both mentioned analysts in your books who would say from 2007, 2008, 2009, just leave this company alone. There's something really dodgy here. One of yours sees him briefs Christo Visa on, and then ends up at Braithwaite, probably Visa himself, and goes back and can't believe what he's found. How come those voices are never listened to? Does Steve Boyson not listen? Doesn't he read analysts that he doesn't agree with, or what? I mean, how does he pick what information to listen to about a company on whose audit committee, well, whose audit committee he chairs? And there are these reports around. Does he just ignore them?
I mean, from my point of view, I think that, you know, it's difficult because we're looking at this in hindsight, a collapsed. If you take another company, take APSA, for example, right now there'll be 5 analyst reports warning of problems here and problems there. And Christovisa says he looked at it, he heard the concerns, delayed investing for 2 years, and then thought, oh, well, these concerns are just somebody who's an ultimate skeptic. I mean, there were always these people. And there were people warning before the credit crunch in America in 2008 that subprime mortgages were going to collapse. Because they weren't in the majority, because they weren't seen as having a certain amount of momentum behind them, you ignore them. And that's what happened in this case. There were lots of guys saying Steinhoff behaves like a schoolyard bully, and they're just terrible, but people ignored that.
Peter, what is this?
It's not only analysts. I mean, in this town specifically, you've got the companies that coalesce around the Remgro Group, Johan Rupert's group, and they were very reluctant from the very beginning to invest in Steinhoff. Mm-hmm. In fact, Steinhoff as an investment opportunity was taken to Yanni Durant, the CEO of Remgro, 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
And he spent time poring over those financials. And yeah, 2 or 3 times he said, we're not touching Steinhoff because we don't understand the business.
Yeah. Mm. And as who's the famous American investor's name?
Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett said, don't invest in what you don't understand. Yeah. And so many people here did.
Because they made money. They were making a ton of money.
But they couldn't understand
it's like Bitcoin.
How.
You go along with Bitcoin while it's going up.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah. Peter, what is... just come back to the question of the future of capitalism in South Africa. I mean, these kinds of shocks, as you say, I mean, James, they're not unique to South Africa, but we're a very small community, and we are not, you know, as robust as the Americans and you know, the French and the Germans when they have their scandals. What is business going to look like, or what is the way we make money going to look like here in, say, 20 years' time? Would it have changed?
It's such a difficult question, Peter. I think in this country, and we're in Stellenbosch now, in such a beautiful town with, you know, with opportunity and wealth and you know, nice houses and all of the rest of it, but you've got Kayamandi just outside of town where you've got thousands of people living in squalor, and that's the picture of this country, isn't it? The gap between the haves and the have-nots, the wealthy and the poor, is such an enormous problem. And if you factor into that, the governing parties struggle with itself around ideology. You know, are they a capitalist party that support the private sector, or, you know, will the socialist tendencies from the early 90s always rear its head? You know, what's the role of the unions? It's difficult to see how it will stay the same as it is now. You know, we have to close the gap between rich and poor. We have to create jobs. Now, a couple of weeks ago at the State of the Nation address, also in the Minister of Finance's budget speech, it was the first time that senior ANC people said, you know, the private sector is the engine of job creation. So that has to happen. But business also is going to have to play a bigger part in the communities where they operate. You know, they are there to make money. It's not a beast with a social conscience, but it's going to have to develop a form of social conscience. You can't divorce politics from economics in this country. So business is going to have to take cognizance of that and to try and spread the wealth better than it has before.
Yeah, I mean, how it does that is another question. But
yes,
just to come back to the diversity of boards. Okay, so we have undiverse board after undiverse board after undiverse board, all out of Wilgehof or wherever they might be. You know, they've been mates forever and they know each other and they kind of, you know, go on holiday together and all that kind of stuff. Is it possible to force diversity on companies? I mean, to basically, you know, is it even wise? I ask because I know that both their campaigns, Hillary Clinton and Theresa May in the UK, talked a little bit about this and about trying to get workers involved more in their companies and trying to get more diversity on board, trying to get more women in the UK, more black people, more, you know, younger people. You do all that. and then think, and I wonder also, I keep forgetting who wrote what in these two fine books, but somebody describes how difficult it is to know when you get a board pack whether anything is true, because you go to the meeting, you get your pack, you've read it, but it's just management telling you something, right? So you want to diversify boards, because it'll stop the kind of Steinhoff thing, you hope. But where do you find people to be those directors?
I'll leave the nitty-gritty of that question to the financial journalist next to me, because I'm not one. But what I have found in research for my book was an almost tick box culture in companies at the moment. You've got the king regulations that companies have to adhere to. So there's a culture when the boards meet that you just have to tick all the boxes before they can go on. And apparently it takes hours and hours before you can actually get down to the business of the company. And by that time, half of the board have lost interest, or you know, the other half haven't read the board packs. But can we always legislate for everything? Can we legislate for diversity? Can we always have a top-down approach on everything? Doesn't there need to be a culture change in how business operates?
I have a slightly different view. I think it's time for shareholders to step up. The PIC, the Government Employees Pension Fund, invested through the PIC, lost $20 billion in Steinhoff. They were sitting on the board, on the AGMs where this board was elected year after year after year, without contesting it. They agreed to the salary packages these guys were getting. Ben LaGrance was getting 50 million package a year, 40 years old, what a lovely job. 50 million, wasn't that a red flag?
There, right?
Yeah, of course, but wasn't that a red flag, do you think? I mean, where are the shareholders that are supposed to say, hang on, what the hell's going on here? Supposed to ask the tough questions. How many AGMs and results meetings have you been to where shareholders ask really tough questions? Very few. And sometimes when there are tough questions, it gets shut down. And I'll mention the guy's name, Chris Becker, only recently, about the share structure, control structure at Naspers. And what happens then? Nothing happens then. And to me, that's an issue. I think shareholders have more power than they know, but and they should influence. So a lot of what happens must also reflect back on them to some extent.
Well, I mean, talking about shareholders, we're going to ask some of the audience to ask you questions in a minute. I mean, but is it possible that, you know, the structure of shareholding in South Africa means that basically it's your shares in X company of going to be represented by a fund manager, that you haven't gone out and bought? I mean, we're not activist shareholders or active shareholders like, say, the Americans are. We don't go and buy shares.
Sure.
We buy them through
Coronation,
unit trust or whatever, or whatever it might be. I mean, Theo Botha can't do this all on his own.
No, he can't, but he certainly seems to be the only one trying to do it. And to my mind, there should be more of that. To my mind, I hear what you're saying, but then we need to understand better who is managing our funds. Do you know who is managing your fund? Do you know who is your medical aid representative representing you at Discovery Health AGMs and meetings where they decide on the hikes? We all have somebody representing us there, but we don't even know what their names are. Do you know who's your ward councillor? But when the election, after election, we complain about the potholes, we don't even know who to call, because we don't even know who's the ward councillor. We all have a bit of responsibility to take, is I think what I'm trying to say.
It's an opaque world, isn't it? I mean, we're the world of high finance is a difficult world to understand, and I would argue politics is much easier to understand. So it's much easier to rant and rave about your local councillor or public representative or MP than it is to figure out what's going on at a business of which you own a very tiny chunk or a larger chunk. It's easier to rant and rave about the ANC than it is to do about the inner workings.
To go to an AGM and say, listen, Mr. Uister, why the hell did you buy a mattress firm?
Well, I think people aren't educated about that, you know. Can I attend an AGM? What can I do at an AGM? Whereas at a political rally, you can shout and rave and do whatever you want.
I mean, we've seen a couple of big sort of failures recently. I mean, EOH has gone down. I mean, what's that going to look like when you unravel?
Yeah, I mean, those companies are, there are a lot of companies that, you know, to go back to your earlier point, I think are creating a sense that capitalism in this country is somehow under siege. But I do think that the legitimacy of the capitalist system is facing other issues. The fact that we have 70% of our adults in this country who aren't in formal employment creates a wider legitimacy of capitalism that people struggle to address. But I think a case like Steinhoff is an exception. I don't think, you know, if you look at all the thousands of companies in this country, I don't think that we can say because of Steinhoff's collapse that the entire system is a fraud, because EOH has issues.
No, but I mean, what I think I'm generally saying is that South African business has behaved badly, and I'm talking about the way they cooperated with the Guptas and on all sorts of levels. And on
Bosasa. Bosasa, look
yeah,
at Bosasa.
Bosasa is a classic, again, too. Yeah. I'm going to ask the audience to put their hands up and ask questions of the panel.
We don't know where the money is.
The money's gone, I think. There are mics on either side. I'll sort of pick out three people at a time. We'll start on that side. And just wait for the mic until you get this. So we'll start with the gentleman who's just been handed the mic. Hi.
Thanks very much. Hi. What I've missed in this discussion so far is that Steinhoff, as I see it, uses this vehicle for people to put funds offshore. That's in one of the books. It's highlighted in a rocket page, and it says there, you know, that. And I think the big players, after, say, Christa Vista got 20% or 25% in cash. Now, I understand that cash was wrong. And these people who were the big players who were using Steinhoff as a vehicle to put their wealth offshore, they were trading before and after each annual report came out. They would have sold off huge quantities and bought back or whatever when, you know, as the prices fluctuated. So I want to know from the panel what they think about, because when I was a student at Stellenbosch in the 70s, soon afterwards, there was a financial rand, and there was a lot of fraud between commercial and financial rand.
Yeah.
And some of my colleagues were actually prosecuted, but when we became a democracy, the NPA just dropped all those financial fraud charges.
Okay,
so, you know, and yesterday in a discussion here, the Smith murders and the new government, people had a hope that they would do it, but the new government plays exactly the same game. People in power do what they want to. And so I just want to know about
nationalists or nationalists.
Wealth offshore.
Yeah.
To what extent was Steinhoff used as just a vehicle to put your wealth offshore? Thank you.
Can I have another hand from this side? No? Have you had anybody like to ask a question? Shall we deal with that? I mean, was this a just simply a way to externalize your capital, rather like the Russians did? When they got a hold of the state machinery?
I can start if you want. I mean, I think that in this case, part of the rationale for listing in Frankfurt was to allow people like Christo Bissa to take their money offshore. Mm. There was a time, say in 2013, 2014, where the Rand just looked like it was destined for 100-1, where every single company, Brakes, famous brands, everyone was buying stuff overseas to hedge against the falling Rand. And I think that to a large extent, a lot of the investors in Steinhoff saw the listing of Steinhoff in Frankfurt as a way to externalize their cash. That's a strong theory, particularly around Christo Visser, that was one of the things that he was doing, was wanting to get his cash out of the country, and that was part of the share swap. And I think that did influence a lot of people's thinking around Steinhoff at the time.
But it's not illegal. It's not illegal, so we've got to understand that. So you can externalize if you get permission from the Reserve Bank. So it's not illegal to go and list in Germany. It's not illegal to use that as a vehicle to take money out of the country. I certainly think that it was a move as well by certain people, including perhaps Dr. Visser. You can only take about 10 million out of the country without real problems per year. So he's got sitting with, he lost 60 billion, Christo Visser. So those billions, getting that out of the country, you go via a route like this, but it's legal. So whether it should be legal is a different question. But we must just mention the fact that it certainly was legal.
Another important point on that is I think that for directors who would have done that as well, the desire to take cash out of the country might have allowed them to be less skeptical of some of the structures that Marcus Huston might have put forward. Because if your incentive is always to look at taking the cash out, you're perhaps less wary about the details of Mattress Firm than the other structures, because that's your primary concern, your primary incentive.
Peter, I've got a question for you.
Me?
Yes. And perhaps for you, Rob, and for you, Peter. Something which I don't have an answer to. It's something that I'm curious about, coincidences. Pierre is here, Yannie Mouton.
Yeah.
Leaves the board, 2016. Within a few weeks or months, PSG has a long-running history with Steinhoff, very close. Mm. One of the biggest shareholders, they sell every single share out of Steinhoff. Is that a coincidence, Peter? What do you think?
No, I just have no idea. You know, I mean, I would need somebody to tell me what to think. I would have to. I mean, I would have to go to an analyst or a Rob Rose or a James Brent Stein and say, what happened? Yeah, I mean, did they know something? But that's 2016. That's a long time ago. That's a year before.
It's an interesting question. I'm not alluding to anything.
Maybe there was a row inside the Mouton family. You know?
Well, they reject that. You know, they hate it when you confront them with that. You know, they deny that was the plan. Mm. But it certainly looks like it. But they don't like talking about it.
Why shouldn't they talk about it? I mean, I would want to know what really motivated that move. I mean, at the time, Steinhoff was shooting the lights out. It was a fantastic investment. Everybody was investing. And it's because this company was doing so phenomenally well for so many years in a large way, I think, which is why so many people were done in and didn't ask the difficult questions, because everyone was making money. Except Piers here decides, Yannie gets out of the... Look, the story that I heard was that when Christo Wiese became chairman, it was two bulls in one kraal, and Yannie said, I'm out of here. But getting rid of your entire stake? Very interesting.
Well, at that stage...
So while you're ahead.
Marcus had already lied to Yannie, to the people around, swapping the PSG shares into Steinhoff. So Yop de Toy, Taste de Toy, and GT Ferreira, he'd said, give me your PSG shares and I'll give you Steinhoff shares. Yeah. And then he told them, I'll go and tell Yannie about this. And he never told them.
And Yannie,
which
Yannie
created huge personal animosity. So if you're part of that, and you've seen Marcus used to lie to three of your most influential colleagues, it does leave a bad taste.
When would Yannie have found out?
He did find out, obviously, because the stakes were then swapped. So he did find out, and they had a meeting, I think, with Yannie.
Would this have been around the time that James is talking about?
This was a bit later. This was after the listing.
And he saw it as betrayal. I mean, he was livid when he heard about it. It was his company. Okay. He was it's his baby. He always thought, you know, his biggest investors, when they sell off, it was almost like selling off a friendship. Yeah. And whenever people sold shares, you know, they would tell Yannie, I'm selling so many shares because of this reason. And all of a sudden, it's this block of shares that disappear.
But they were still making wine together.
I think that's
for a while still.
But then GT had said to Marcus, you know, I'll go and tell Yannie that I'm selling the shares. And Marcus said to him, don't tell Yannie. I'll go tell Yannie.
Yeah.
And then he never did, which it made GT and Taste and those guys feel very upset about
it. It comes back to the story of betrayal. I mean, that's Marcus Huster's, not only on a professional, big business level, but on a very intimate, interpersonal level. He betrayed all his closest friends.
What does he do? I mean, do you know, you guys have written about him. What does he do all day? What does he do? What is he doing today?
What are you doing, Hermanus?
He's apparently quite, you see, he willies often and he gyms quite often. So that's about
it. He was seen drinking whiskey at the Tiger Valley waterfront the week before last.
Perhaps
2 o'clock in the afternoon. Perhaps
another question, Rob, and Peter, I hope you don't mind, because it's the issues that puzzle me as well. Christo Wiese, did he know? Was he in on this? Put up your hands, those of you who think Christo Wiese knew.
Wow.
Okay, so about a quarter of the room thinks Christo Wiese knew what was going on.
What do you think?
How could he? I mean, you've got to say, how could he not? You know? Why do you pay more than double the share price for a mattress company?
But would you willingly give up 60 billion rand? Would you do that? Would you put your money in something that you know...
And you're going to put ShopRite in as well.
And you're going to put ShopRite... Oh, well, by the way, is this... I mean... The hero in all of this is Wati Basson. that's what I came away from your two books thinking. Imagine the satisfaction of being him.
Wati Basson.
Dodged a bullet.
Absolutely. I mean, completely. Just brilliant.
Well, you know, Christo Wiese's, the way that he engaged with ShopRite as well was pretty hands-off. That was his way of doing things. So a lot of people are saying, you know, he went in with the same approach and attitude to Steinhoff because he trusts... He always trusted Whitey, you know. Marcus is a hot shot. Everyone likes him. Well, not everyone, but you know,
he made money.
His business is flying.
And
so
do they never
leave him be?
The stories of him bullying people and being cruel and bringing people down, humiliating people. Did the Steve Boysons and the Christo Vitas never see that?
You know, Christo, I asked Christo about that, and he said like a lot of my executives behave in a very self-confident way. In other words, you know, a lot of his CEOs are bullies to some extent, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's that culture, especially in the 90s, was valued. You know, go-getter, somebody who's not, who's, it's very easy to blur that into somebody who's not scared to speak their mind and is forthright. And it's a small step to being a complete bully who.
Not all bullies get their comeuppance. I mean, but he certainly has. And I mean, I think we don't know this full story of the Tongaat Hewlett share price collapse yet, but I'm sure there's a story behind that. Would anybody like to ask any of the panel something? There we go, sir. Just hang on a sec. Just wait for the microphone.
The microphone is op pad. Daar is hy.
Thank you.
Ek wil net by weet die Amerikaanse bankrot firma wat Steinhoff gekoop het, wat se effek het dit op Steinhoff massies?
Die bankrot Amerikaanse firma Mattress Firm, wat se effek het dit gehad? So wel in die langer skema van dinge was dit natuurlik 'n dud. Dit het maar dit het nie die maatskappy tot sy insinking gelei nie, maar dit het definitief gelei tot die Viceroy ondersoekspan wat in Amerika sit, wat gesê het, want Viceroy was is 'n klomp ouens wat basies speel met geld. So hulle ondersoekmaatskappy en hulle was besig om Mattress Firm te ondersoek. Toe sê hulle maar Mattress Firm is $29, maar hy's eintlik werd baie minder as dit, to short hulle Mattress Firm. En toe kom Steinhoff in en koop Mattress Firm vir $64 'n aandeel. En toe sê Viceroy, hang on, hier's 'n vrotvis in die water, en hulle begin toe met hulle moerse ondersoek in diepte. En dit was soort van die een groot domino wat toe val, want toe Marcus bedank die Desember, daai Vrydag, Maandag aand, die volgende dag, die 6de, toe sit Viceroy daai verslag uit waar hulle eintlik vir amper 2 jaar al vir Steinhoff ondersoek het en sê hierso snaakse goed, hier snaakse mense, en is 'n baie deurdagte verslag. So tot 'n mate het daai aankoop gelei tot die heel algehele ineenstorting, glo ek, maar op daai korttermyn aankoop dink ek nie daar was 'n onmiddellike effekie omdat hierdie maatskappy Steinhoff so 'n enorme maatskappy was.
What was Viceroy shorting? Was Viceroy shorting?
Viceroy was shorting Mattress Firm.
Okay.
So they couldn't understand. They'd never heard of Steinhoff until they were Mattress Firm was bought out, and they couldn't understand this.
Yeah. More questions. There we go, sir.
Hello. Die vraag wat ek wil vra net is, hoekom sal hulle so konsentreer die hele tyd net oor Mattress Firm en nie oor plaaslike transaksies wat gedoen is nie? Is dit oor die grootte van die transaksies? Want daar's plaaslike transaksies wat plaasgevind het wat op dieselfde manier plaasgevind het, wat daar baie definitief ook dubbel betaal is vir besighede.
Rob, do you want to take this? Why is hoekom is daar gefokus deur wie? Deur die Viceroy?
Nee. Net die fokus wat jy almal praat heeltyd oor Mattress Firm,
So why are we only speaking about Mattress Firm when there were so many other examples of
including local
companies where they did the same thing, overpaying by a massive extent?
Do you want to? I mean, I think that they did that for a long time. JD Group, for example, was selling clothes on credit through Joshua Dorr, and you know, it's the quality wasn't often great. You'd go there and you know sit on the couches and they'd fall apart. So there's some really crap things they bought. And for a long time, Steinhoff didn't have proper cash flows. But when they bought Pepco brought them real cash flows. Pepco was a real business. There was a guy who I spoke to, who was the head of research, who said that it's like Steinhoff was the mafia. And by buying Pepco, they decided to go straight and buy a chain of legit dry cleaners. So finally, they decided to do something. And so that is what convinced a lot of people to invest. But, you know, so they had done dodgy deals before. They'd overpaid for assets, and a lot of people didn't invest, which is why the share was relatively cheap for a long time. So if you just look at the P.E. ratios and those kind of things, you'd say, like, oh, Steinhoff's quite cheap. But actually, there's a reason why they were cheap. People steered away from them because of these deals. Then Pepco was the one that brought them. It brought them Christo Visser, and it brought them actual cash flow. And it just is bad luck that people invested after that. And 3 years later, it collapsed.
And also, they seemed quite desperate to enter the North American market as well. You know, it was an opportunity for them to expand beyond Europe and America. And they made quite a big fist, a big deal of their expansion into the States. But also in America, it wasn't regarded as too flash of a business. And they expanded quite quickly from a number of smaller retail stores to where they are now, something like 3,000 spaces that they've got now.
Are we agreed that basically when a South African company decides to invest abroad, in you dollar. Sell its shares? That's
go to America, especially, and perhaps Australia.
I mean, they all come back. Breweries, some of them don't even exist anymore.
Yes.
It's just crazy.
And also what was funny about the mattress world thing was people don't go to stores anymore to buy mattresses. You know, they buy it over the internet. So when the analysts in the States saw, you know, this weird company from Africa or Europe, they couldn't figure out where it came from, investing in the States. You know, why would you invest in a business that's actually shrinking or in an industry that's shrinking? And you know, they wanted to expand it. So it was.
Don't say that too loudly. We're journalists.
We've got time for one last question. There we go.
So terwyl ons wag vir die mic, ons daar is ander maatskappye, ons het 'n bietjie voor hulle gepraat in die boeke ook. Maar Mattress Firm was net op so 'n skaal dat dit interessant is om te bespreek, dink ek.
It was the most clear, yeah.
Yeah.
But the model of doing business basically with yourself or your friends,
yes,
is just replicated. It just seamlessly moves from South Africa to offshore.
Australia.
Same thing.
Die mense tree nie op namens my vir wie hy eintlik werk, vir wie hy beleggings doen. Hulle is traag. Ek gaan nie my ervaring vertel. My werk se pensioenfonds toe ek Soma, se Mega. Toe hierdie ding begin uitkom, toe kom daar later 'n briefie uit wat sê moenie bekommerd wees nie, dis net 2% van ons belegging.
Ja.
Al sit 'n mooi storie.
Ja, presies.
Soft selling.
Ja.
Okay. Ek is 'n bietjie moeiliker averegse tipe persoon. Ek het gesê, nee meneer, dis 2%, maar wat gaan jy doen? Jy vat elke maand jou geld by my. Wat gaan jy vir my doen met jou kliënt is? Hoe het jy, sê vir my ook, hoe het jy die besluite geneem? Hierdie goed is nie altyd deursigtig nie, so ek is 'n oopkop mens, maar sê vir my, hoe het jy gekyk na Steinhof? Hoe het jy besluit om my geld daarin te sit? Ek het eerstens van ons Board of Trustees 'n baie dwarsklap gekry. Hoe durf ek as 'n lid van die pensioenfonds sit of vra? Jy weet, almal het my so skeef aangekyk. Daarna het ek van die pensioenfonds af so nog 'n safsou briefie gekry, asof ek onnoosel is. Die aandelemark het risiko's en hierdie goedjies gebeur en al sulke mooi sop storietjies, jy weet. Dis waar myself verteenwoordig is. Ons wil nie Peter in die goeders nie. Ons wil nie in die binnenkringe Peter van die Afrikaner rondgaan nie. Ek het ook beleggings by Coronation, Grey en Investing. Ek het vir hulle e-pos gestuur en gesê, meneer, julle vat elke maand van my fooie om namens my beleggings te doen. Julle het seker besluite namens my goed gemaak. Ek dink dit sal net billik wees as julle ook wat groot, sterk maatskappye is, kragtige ouens. As so iets gebeur, sal optree teenoor sulke individue, want dan gaan jy 'n boodskap uitstuur na die volgende ou toe.
Ja.
I'm going to ask
you. Ek is nou klaar. En wat het gebeur? Nog 3 maande later het geloop. Toe was daar ook sulke flou verklaringies van ons gaan optree en ons gaan saamwerk met die class action. Maar dit is presies so storieetjie.
I want to ask James to respond to that. It's a final question. We've already run out of time.
So die vraag gaan oor die optrede van aandeelhouers en wat kan hulle doen en wanneer daar soos hierdie meneer sê hy het die ouens genader wat die fondse bestuur en vra maar hoe het julle besluit oor Steinhoff? Wat se gevolge gaan daar wees? En ek dink dis 'n uitstekende vraag. En ek meen soos Rob gesê het omtrent 70%, ek dink is 'n bietjie meer van al die pensioenfonde in ons land het geld verloor in Steinhoff. Hoeveel mense het actually vir daai ouens gevra? Julle is die fondsbestuurders Coronation, Alan Gray. Julle is die ouens wat die skills het wat fondse vat elke maand van ons almal af om ons fondse te bestuur en julle stuur 'n briefie uit en sê ja, ons het net 2% verloor. Wel, wat gaan julle doen daaromtrent? Want as ons saamstem dat die regstelsel 'n bietjie in die moeilikheid is, nie daar gaan ons nie joy kry nie. En hierdie ouens loop hier rond. Wat is daar om ons te beskerm teen soortgelyke wrongdoing in die toekoms en of gaan Alan Gray en Sanlam en wie ook al het is, volgende jaar is daar EOH ook geduik het vir ons net weer 'n briefie stuur en sê, sorry, hierdie jaar gaan jy weer 2% verloor. Daai ouens gaan moet begin opstaan en sê, wel, ons tree op namens pensionarisse, ons moet met ander mense se fonds bestuur en daarom het ons ook 'n verantwoordelikheid as 'n Coronation of 'n Alan Gray voorbeeld om op te tree en of het hofsake is wat hulle moet gaan maak of hulle al hulle besluitnemings goed, ek meen hoeveel base van fond, I don't know of any Rob, hoeveel base van 'n fondsbestuurder wat baie geld verloor het in Steinhoff, het hulle in die hek geduik?
Ja. Yeah. Ja. Yeah. Listen, thank you. I agree. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's been great to talk to all three of our participants. Thank you very much for arriving. I want you not to worry too much about Steinhoff in the future, because I absolutely promise you that before this year is out, Marcus Juster will be in handcuffs, even if it's just for a photo opportunity before his lawyers spring. But it will happen. Thank you very much.